Wowie with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hello and welcome to Robots episode 113. My name is Jana, and in today's episode, we hear from Wowie RoboSapien creator Mark Tilden. But first, as always, here are the latest robotics news with Christine.
Thank you, Jana. Rethink Robotics, the company formerly called Heartland Robotics, founded by Rodney Brooks, has emerged from 4 years of stealth mode and introduced its first product, a two-armed robot. Baxter consists of 2 7-degree-of-freedom robot arms with a torso and head with an integrated vision system. Both robot arms are back-drivable, and the robot is capable of detecting humans entering its workspace, making it safe to operate elbow-to-elbow with human workers. A training mode allows users to program the robot by demonstration. It remains to be seen if the robot provides enough functionality for everyday use in real manufacturing environments. But with its low retail price of $22,000, Baxter has a real shot at living up to the company's long-touted tagline of rethinking America's manufacturing. In other news, U.S. company iRobot has acquired U.S. company Evolution Robotics. Evolution Robotics' main product, the Mint Vacuum Cleaner series, as well as its North Star positioning system and Visual Slam algorithms, are a great match with iRobot's vacuum cleaner business. As part of the deal, Evolution Robotics founder and former CEO Paolo Pirjanian will become iRobot's new CTO. The $74 million US dollar cash deal is expected to close in quarter 4 of 2012. Finally, researchers at the EPFL in Lausanne, Switzerland have released a new educational robot. The Timio 2 is a two-wheeled robot about the size of a large hand. It is equipped with 7 infrared proximity sensors and 2 ground sensors, an accelerometer, a temperature sensor, speaker and microphone, as well as an infrared receiver, USB connection, memory card slot, and comes complete with a sophisticated, easy-to-use software development environment that allows even children to program the robot. The Timio 2 readily connects with Lego bricks. A wiki page collects building examples, including anything from simple programs to allow Timio to balance on a ball, to converting it into a musical instrument, to paper-cut toys and drawing machines. The robot is developed and sold by the Mopsia Association, a non-profit based at the university and run by the university's researchers. The entire project, including all hardware and software, is open source. The robot is sold at cost, without profit margin or distribution cost, which explains its incredibly low cost of 99 Swiss francs, or roughly $100. For more information on Baxter, or iRobot's new acquisition, as well as Timio 2, visit our website at www.robotspodcast.com.
Mark Tilden is a robotics physicist and, while at the University of Waterloo in Canada, founded Beam Robotics, which describes an approach to robotic motion using analog circuits rather than microprocessors. Mark went on to develop a whole range of biomorphic robot-based items, including the Wowie RoboSapien, which revolutionized the way we interact with entertainment robots. Since Wowie, many more of his robots have gone on sale, and some even featured in big-screen movies such as The X-Men. Our reporter Pear met up with Mark in Hong Kong, where he currently works as a freelance robotics designer, consultant, and lecturer.
Today we're here with Mark Tilden, and we're going to talk about robotics in general, progress we've seen over the last couple of years, or basically anything he'd like to share with us. So we're going to start looking at his robots and go through them a bit, and we'll discover many interesting things, I think.
Okay.
So should we start anywhere that you think is significant? We talked to you in 2008. Femisapien had just emerged on the market.
When Femisapien had just come out.
Yeah, yeah. Is there any? Should we pick up there and see what happens? Or
well, I'm not sure if we basically talked about the history that came before Femisapien.
Yeah, I mean, let's do that.
What was interesting is that Robosapien was still very much of its heyday. And what happened is I'd taken my beam technology and turned it into this inexpensive humanoid technology. And then through the Huawei company, we wound up putting over a dozen robots, which were all just advanced experiments to basically prove my idea of optimizing performance to silicon. That is, try to come up with something which is as cool as any humanoid robot you can manage for just the smallest amount of money. Because I believe that, you know, we aren't going to have, you know, like the robot uprising until the robots are affordable, right? And that's a big thing about a lot of my bottom-up technology here. Femisapien was at the time probably the most sophisticated robot humanoid I'd ever built. And it had been 5 years since we built a Robosapien, which is sort of like a walking gorilla. And the fact was is that she still is, a very efficient, very human-looking humanoid, which is interesting because she looks human on the outside, but she's all, you know, like advanced evolved robot from the inside. And since then, we came up with JoBot, which can actually listen and talk back to you in English, although he also speaks German, Dutch, French, and Chinese. And then, of course, the many other robots. The business has sort of like faded away. That is, the market for entertainment robots is essentially saturated now. And what I'm currently doing now is exploring various different spaces in trying to make robots that are just entertain you, but actually do something real, right? Something that you actually need to get done. That's going to be an interesting thing for the 21st century because it has to be and look as sophisticated as a cell phone, but as easy to interact with as an R2-D2. And I've got some beautiful designs along those lines, but we'll have to see whether or not they actually make it to market at all.
Mm-hmm. What kind of tasks are you addressing?
Here's a simple thing. You're away from your house for, say, up to a month or so.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't it be nice to have something that walks around, and every time there's a noise, all of a sudden it takes a photograph.
Mm-hmm.
And if that noise continues, it starts taking video. Okay, and then ships that to your cell phone or email account, no matter where you are. So even if the robot is destroyed, the fact is that the information, the evidence, is still basically there in your pocket. You know, is your brother coming in and stealing your Halloween candy? You know, that's like the low-end application of that. But the top-end application is something where you have a hyper-efficient robot. And that's one of the nice things about the biomorphic robotics technology that I've developed. I mean, people don't recognize just how efficient it is. When you basically build something, you know, that is structurally and mechanically and electrically as efficient as they are, you want to get battery lives that basically can be measured in man weeks and not just man minutes, like you get with a lot of these, what I call forced feedback control technologies, like these humanoids that you see out of Japan and stuff. Maximum battery life is maybe an hour. Okay. Well, if the robots ever try to take over, that's going to make for a really short war. Okay. But if you need something to actually do work for you, right, you're going to need at least 3 weeks of it wandering your place without you having to change its batteries. Okay. And these are the sort of realities that essentially we're going to apply and put our technology into.
As somebody that manages properties, I certainly see a use of something that is more flexible. Or certainly, I could put in a system doing one thing, but I want something flexible that could adapt to whatever task was at hand. That I, as you said, there was a sound, there was a problem. I get information, and then I can make the robot take basic, simple actions. That would be just great.
Well, simple things like something you could walk up and down behind the walls of a building, right? Walking through the pipes, walking through the electricals, looking for electrical hotspots, right? Were you silly enough to put aluminum wiring, for example? Woohoo! Then you could be having a hotspot problem. And of course, even with older properties, being able to put these sort of things and knowing that they have the ability and versatility to be able to give you information accurately without the necessary costs that would come from sort of, you know, putting in a totally integrated system. I mean, wiring a building is a massive cost. But if for exactly one-tenth the cost, I could give you a small, high-reliability robot that will run for years, then basically you're looking at something that's pretty cool. And these are the range of applications. I mean, I've speculated that the future of robotics is going to be robo-tourism, right? So in other words, you could be wherever you are on your laptop and then run a robot in, say, Australia to look at resorts. Robo-shopping, where you can be in Switzerland and all of a sudden basically like get a robot to basically go shopping for you in Hong Kong, right, $4 or $5 a minute, okay? And then ultimately, from what we learned from these things, we could finally get to the Holy Grail, which is a robo home assistance. That is a $1,000 humanoid that essentially will look after your parents in their own house for as long as they want to stay there. And that's something which is fairly important. It also has to be built out of rubber so that if my mother beats the crap out of it, right, you know, it'll just, you know, won't hurt her hand and just go away into the closet.
Safety and security there, we touched on that a bit, is also very important. Do you see any problems we haven't solved on any roadways ahead there?
Oh, there's huge numbers. I mean, for example, the ones that I'm currently working on just right now is robot self-grooming. Okay. In other words, you forget, you know, like human beings wind up basically like slough off our skin and we basically take a shower. Well, how does a robot stay clean? Especially if it's in continuous operation, it's going to get dusty, it's going to get dirty, it's going to get filthy. And the thing is that it needs to have the same sort of basic skills that you might see on a common housefly, where if nobody's trying to kill it, you know, like, okay, I'm just going to scrape my eyes off and, you know, like clean my body. We're trying to come up with robots that can do that. One of the big problems we're facing right now is recognition, avoidance, and path navigation. So once you've got a human-sized robot that can walk as fast as a human being, first off, it scares people. But second off, how do you solve the problem of the young child problem? That is, it's one thing to basically like walk through a mall, but if there's a small child, they do not basically have interactive operations that you'd normally expect from, say, grown-ups, okay? All of a sudden, you've got a machine that basically is walking up to a child that does not know to get out of the way of a large walking device. And how do you basically avoid, you know, these sort of traps, okay? I mean, robots are, like, we've had to build roads around the world to basically separate cars from human beings, okay? But how do robots do this? I mean, robots are supposed to basically work both indoors and outdoors and even behind walls.
And together with us in another sense, rather than in the car, we are in the car and we can separate ourselves from, with the road being one thing and the rest of the world being another thing. But robots should work with us and then much more complicated interactions.
It's exactly right. My colleague, RIP, Rob Russell Hoslock, and I came up with a concept called parallel life. So in other words, there's us and there's nature, right? And rather than robots basically just sort of like, you know, be our agents for forcing nature, what they should be is something which is sort of like a parallel life between that. So, and I basically wrote stories told about my old robot, Robo-Ecology, and some of them are actually still over there, where the robot Venus flytrap would crush and kill flies that would drop flies onto the floor, or my robot Dust Bunny Cowboys would sweep them up. Right, you know, and then the robot window washers would basically sort of, you know, like scrape off all the remnants. And it's amazing because all of these things are self-contained, solar-powered, dishwasher safe. Okay, and that was beautiful. All of a sudden, realizing that this was something that was small and elegant. So even now, even though you can hear some little robots basically still living and trapped behind their little glass containers here, the cool thing is that I found that if you're going to have something where you a robot you can actually live with, it has to do a task, but it has to do it quietly, elegantly. And, of course, basically, you know, like in conjunction with human beings, not just, you know, like under control of them. So this is why I distinguish sort of like autonomous robots from, say, teleoperator robots. It's one thing to sort of like, you know, take a cell phone and suddenly, you know, like drive a car around. That's remote control. This is something which essentially is a whole class of autonomous, self-motivated, self-actuated vehicles, which are capable of basically doing projects and tasks for you, even when you're not around to basically supervise them.
Yeah, that would be very helpful, I think. And also from a security point of view, it'd be nice to know that everything is okay. And
sure. I mean, there are little things. For example, if you do a lot of traveling around Asia, like I do, one of the things, for example, that I've put out is sort of a modification of my little friend, the Robobo over here, which, you know, basically is a big, noisy sort of snake-like machine. But imagine a small something. So you're sitting on a very sketchy, very strange bed in a hotel somewhere, and you go to sleep, and all of a sudden this little, your alarm clock wakes up, scans the room. So if anybody tries to come in, it makes a loud noise loud enough to basically, you know, like bring anybody to come running. I mean, these are the sort of simple technologies that essentially will become very available. But it can't just be that. It's also got to be a good alarm clock. It also help if it was a cell phone charger. It would also help if... So in other words, what would it take to come up with sort of like the universal R2-D2s that we've dreamed about for a long time from Star Wars? Remember, R2-D2 was a great fictional comic device because he always came up with a tool for whenever he needed it, right? You know, even in the last movies, he was able to fly. Well, why wasn't he able to do that in some of the first movies when he was stuck in a swamp, right? You know? But the thing was that was great for the science fiction movies. But the thing is, what would it take so that you could have a technology that even your wife would want to take on a travel trip, and it would perform actions and do things for her that essentially are necessary.
Basically, a technical companion to us, like our cell phone is a communication companion, but this is a companion that could lift stuff for you.
Passive companion. And what's interesting is that RoboSapien was a very interesting social experiment from a lot of points of view. In 2004, RoboSapien hit the markets, and the fact was is that children around the world saw their first, you know, interactive, capable robot that was their size. Now they're basically a little older, and now these robots have become like passive background for the entertainment industry. The market was there; it sort of faded apart. Cell phones were still paying too much attention to them. But after a while, I think they're going to become passive as well. We won't even care how they do what they do. They just basically are going to be able to do it for us. And then it comes in. What I'd like to do is we're still waiting for the next generation of robotics to basically enter that. And this is what we did with the field of robots. I mean, we put out over 22 million of these entertainment robots. And the great thing was is that basically told a lot of people what can be done, what you can expect from entertainment robot. We saturated the field, started with Sony and their little Aibo dog, basically ended, you know, like with things like the JoBot, which is able to walk, talk, and listen for less than $50. I mean, that was great. But now everybody's going to ask, okay, great, well, it entertains my kid. What can it do for me? I'm a grown-up, you know, like I'm a teenager who basically has his own cell phone. This is why we've done things like explorations on, for example, the Spherio and the robotics technologies that are coming out there that is trying to meld the passive technology of the app world with sort of like the realistic expectations of what we can do in the robot world. Nobody's going to let your, no wife is going to let you spend, you know, $3,000 or $4,000 on a toy robot for home while the kid basically still needs clothes. You know, these are the sort of problems that we're trying to face. But the cool thing about the beam and biomorphic technologies is that we're able to reduce the costs of basically building something for real and put it on the shelves, right, for, you know, like dozens or hundreds of dollars rather than thousands. And we're basically trying to force that technology now from the entertainment to the real. I mean, we basically succeeded in our test project. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Our toy project, all of my robots up until now. I mean, when I was a scientist, I was developing the technology. Here in Hong Kong, we basically took that technology, applied it to the market, and it wound up working. And then what we're doing is taking up that technology now to a brand new level. That is that it's all social experiments, okay? The reason why people, you look at the old science fiction movies from the 1950s, and like, oh, the evil robot will destroy us all. Well, because evil robots weren't around. I mean, even good robots weren't around. They weren't common enough. But now what we've done is that we basically fulfilled the social contract of letting people know what robots can actually be and how scary they actually are. And one of the things that I'm glad RoboSapien did, as with all of our robots, is they've shown an entire generation of kids that robots don't have to be scary. That even these guys, who are as efficient and as powerful as we could possibly make them, are by no means a necessary threat. That basically, just like the same way, you know, you're always smarter than a dog, even though the dog might be sharper and faster and stronger than you are. The fact is, it's dumber, okay? And this is the nice thing, at least right now, is that robots are dumber. And we can actually start using them and basically looking at a brand new level of marketing. It's a social experiment taking it to the next logical level. How do we make robots a passive part of your life that your wife will say, oh, hi, honey, while you're by the store, pick up a couple of robots, will you? You know, that sort of thing.
Or simply like today with cell phones again and TVs and, for instance, stuff around us like that, that we become dependent on them. We use them. We have a deep need for them. We cannot just say that, oh, this is a fun thing on the side, but this is an integral part of our life. It does critical stuff for us. And it also does that in a general way. For instance, I'm thinking if we have one of these smart robots in a home, we could check, did I turn off the stove? I forgot to take the laundry out of the washing machine, put it in the tumbler. Certainly we could have single devices that we could connect our stove to the internet and stuff like that, but it wouldn't be general. It would be one system for every task rather than system.
But the thing was that we're not talking about something like we basically love this sort of thing, like the nature of technologies, and we'll actually embrace it. We basically learn the necessary background. But if you were to try and put something like that into, say, your grandmother's house, she doesn't want a new internet-connected stove. She wants a machine that basically will, when she's not around, come out, clean up the kitchen, turn off the stove, do the laundry, and then put itself away, right? Even when, so she doesn't have to see it. She wants a mode which is sort of like, I see you, I don't see you, okay? And that is not just making something which is compatible with the customers of the future, but the customers of the past, And this is one of the big things. I mean, like, better robots for better humanity. And that is not making something which basically comes with an instruction manual and you have to learn somebody a brand new technology just from the get-go. What you need is something which basically fulfills an awful lot of these social contracts that I remember from old sci-fi. If you read a lot of the original Isaac Asimov, you know, like from the 1930s, for Christ's sakes, you'll realize that there are things like, you know, robots that look after children, and they could read books, but they weren't able to. They weren't able to talk. I mean, there are all kinds of little conditions. But the thing is that these were social interactions, moral choices. You know, nothing more than a morality plays for what you would do when all of a sudden you have disposable human beings. I mean, that basically winds up having its own horrible ramifications in and of itself. But the thing is that we can put up with this in the same way you can put up with, say, you know, like dogs and cats and sheep. You know, like, yes, they're cute and fluffy and stuff like that, but they're dumb. So we don't feel too bad about turning them to dinner, okay? What's it going to mean, for example, for, say, real-life documentaries? When you can finally have a humanoid cameraman that, for money, you can give it a camera and say, okay, I want you to swing on that vine over that live lava, right? There's a new volcano exploding into Iceland, right? Go in there, film it from close up, right? Because the robot cameraman isn't as worth as much as the incredible videos and the information that you get from basically being that close, okay? I mean, you got to take a look at the horrible reality of the way that human beings are being, like, sending people into space is getting more expensive all the time.
It's also dangerous, and yeah.
But I mean, this is just it. I mean, it's exactly as predicted by a gentleman by the name of Doherty back in the 1990s, and he said that by 2012, the cost of insuring an astronaut will basically be the same cost as sending the astronaut into space. That happened. And as a consequence, now I've got an awful lot of my fellow colleagues in the United States, you know, like astronauts, just sitting around in their spacesuits watching TV, you know, because there's no place for them to go.
We could pay for the trip, but we can't insure them.
But there's another way, and that is that how could we reduce the cost and the risk of going to space? Well, that is if all of a sudden you've got robots that basically sort of like, you know, like people the planet. I mean, the thing is, we were talking about parallel life, what we were doing is we were talking about putting in a parallel ecology, the technology necessary so you can surround yourself with machines that automatically replace the things that Mother Nature does when you're out in the jungle, okay? Where is that pertinent? Well, not here much on Earth because, you know, like we've got nature. But on the moon, for example, you can't go to the moon because it's dusty. The dust up there essentially will clog machines very badly. But if you were to do something like, say, have giant machines up there that could sort of like go up there, burn some tiles, turn it into a giant, beautiful patio, right? And then you send up new robots, which just sweep the dust off that patio. When you go to land on that patio, all of a sudden you're living in a dust-free environment. All of a sudden you set up your first mall on space. The thing is that those little automatic machines, and that's well within our technology, would be the necessary step to basically not just colonizing the moon, but colonizing pretty much any place on the planet. In the universe. For example, these guys who basically are going out to get asteroids. Well, they just have to take a look at some of the Juno missions and otherwise, and they suddenly realize that the real problem with asteroids is that they're mostly extremely fine, abrasive dust. And if you disturb them, all of a sudden you're living in silt. And you have to wait, you know, like months for that stuff to settle down, even the microgravity of space. So what you need is something out there which basically will say, this asteroid is dirty. Robot, clean it up. And once you do that, once you've actually sort of like, you know, reduced these things down so that you now can live there, you suddenly realize that this is what the future is really going to be. Not just robots that essentially are doing the science fiction things we want, like the social interaction, but things that do automatic processes for us. So it allows us to live in space without having to worry about, you know, oh, did I hook up the appropriate air hose? Something like everything from an intelligent spacesuit. But the idea of basically like terraforming or a sheet forming an entire surface of the moon, not just building tiles, but making sure that there are low-efficiency solar cells all connected together. So all of a sudden you land and you've got not just a clean environment, but also power. Well, hey, you know, that's a lot less power, a lot less material to have to take to space. But also it's not just there. I mean, like, for example, the desert, right? You know, like in places on the planet Earth, like, let's face it, we're growing more and more. And, you know, like desert takes up an awful lot of space. Well, fortunately, there's a lot of sand there, and sand makes two things. Bricks and solar cells.
So that would be the same small, well within our capability, intelligent machine.
The thing was, there are deserts around the world which are so hot and dry and vicious that no living thing can survive. Not true. Solar-powered, self-contained, autonomous robots can survive there very nicely. And if you build them strong enough and well enough so they last for 20 years and they're made from the same materials that they're made from in the environment, then even when they break down, essentially they're just nothing more than part of the natural world. I like these ideas. I like the idea of things like Botcrete, okay, where you just have these little hexagonal textiles. You just drop them on top of a roof of a building or a tent or wherever you are, and they self-assemble themselves into a little self-repairing, self-assembled solar cell, and all of a sudden you've got power to run your refrigerator. I mean, that's what's so cool. And when you want to clean up your solar cells, you just pick them all up and put them into a bag.
Yeah,
so I love the idea. Well, solar cells right now, they're great, and it's the future of technology. But the fact is that they're large and fragile, and they're hard to manage. But if you had intelligent individual solar cells, right, they sort themselves out, you bust them up, and they pull themselves together. And when you don't need them, you just put them into a bag and you can carry them like you would a sack. So wherever you go, all of a sudden now you have Simplico. You want a solar power to basically charge your cell phone or run your refrigerator or run anything else, you just drop the bag, they pull out, they pull themselves into a little solar-powered mat, and you got all the juice you need in the world. And if you lose a couple of dozen, who cares?
Yeah, because since they're identical and made in large quantities and really small, each individual bun doesn't cost that.
It sounds sci-fi, except for the prototypes are right behind you, right?
Yeah.
They've been working now for 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, hi, there's a future here, boys.
Yeah.
But the thing, what's interesting is to take a look at the way that is different from the conventional, so like top-down robotic approach, which is everybody wants a C-3PO, or everybody wants an R2-D2, and it's the assumption that we have to come up with a singularity. We have to find some way to put a Watson on a chip, and then it basically will work something. Well, hasn't worked that I've seen. What's frustrating is that the current trend is still to try and build better brains, right? Whereas I've been pushing for years, you be better bodies, okay? Once you've got really good bodies, okay, then you can start putting in better brains and the bodies will match that. But good programming will never make up for bad mechanics. And that's one of the things that we're trying to show here. The great thing about the RoboSapien line is that now getting is old enough so that even when you pick these things up at, say, a garage sale, the cool thing is that it's now cheap enough for you to sort of like, you know, go in and hack it and modify it and improve it. And hopefully this is not just going to generate a whole new generation of robots, but roboticists. And that was the big reason I basically went into sort of like, you know, toys and kits. And a lot of these things are still online and available through solobotics.com and eBay. And as I said, just check out your local junk shops if you want to basically get yourself a nice little RoboSapien. I was able to still burp and fart his way into your heart.
Yeah, and you could disassemble that because it wasn't very expensive to buy. If you do some error, just go and buy another one. And you can build whatever you want and whatever you could imagine with these parts.
These are designed to be hacked in exactly that sort of way. I mean, for example, if you take a look at chances are in your house, there's probably a junk drawer filled with extremely obsolete but too expensive to take apart cameras and cell phones and TVs and cameras and what radios and all kinds of stuff. And it's just a stigmata. You're like, oh, that camera used to cost me $300. You know, I know it's worthless now, but you can't take it apart for its motors. Well, the cool thing about these things is one screwdriver takes them right down to the ground. Everything's labeled. Everything's color-coded. And these things are just loaded with secrets. And I'm glad to say that there's a lot of websites out there, for example, that still have you know, links and connections to basically getting a lot of these things out, how to actually explore them, how to basically do things with them. And build new generations of them, which is what I was really hoping for.
The labeling and the documentation, I think, is also a huge difference between these kind of systems and the young camera, because that there's no documentation.
It's fiddly inside of a camera. Yeah, you ever tear apart a cell phone and suddenly realize, oh, well, I'm not going to repair this right away.
No, and there's no documentation. But even if I wanted to try to, it's all proprietary. It's all locked down. It's all... stay out of it. This is open technology.
Well, there are some things, for example, I was going to talk to you about, you know, like some of my modular robotics things. But for example, one of the things that a lot of people, you know, never quite realized is that RoboSapien, for example, the reason he works is because he winds up being, if you take a look, based upon a perfect hexagon. So all of his motors and various other things are perfectly labeled and perfectly oriented to basically sort of like fulfill, you know, like these appropriate resonance structures just because of position. Now, the thing is, we took that same thing, we expanded it and changed it. But if you take a look at FemiSapien, right, he was as humanoid as you can get. And you suddenly realize, well, he's just a thinner, taller version, okay? But he turns out to be infinitely more efficient because we basically improved our efficiencies in a lot of different sort of ways. The point is that one of the things I like to do is that take one of these guys out, rip out his digital brains, and then throw in the original analog brains. And guess what? Battery life goes up by 4 times. Efficiency goes up by 4 times. You find all the secret walking modes. I mean, what's great about these things is that the body can stay the same, but the controller can go very primitive, and you can discover all kinds of brand new realms. And don't forget, these guys don't use, you know, like feedback control systems like they do with standard servo systems, which are expensive. These guys just use the standard sort of open loop motors with what is called KX squared suspension. And they're so tough, they can take a tumble down the stairs. So what's great about these things is, as an experimental platform, as long as your electronic can take it, I know the body can.
And that also gives you the freedom to experiment and to create things, because you know you're not going to break it.
To make mistakes.
Yeah, to make mistakes.
The thing
exactly.
Is that, because you, fact is that you go to every robot lab in the world, right? And you'll find out if they have a beautiful robot, chances are it's on its own private room, stand back, don't touch, basically be very careful, right? You know, chances of you getting your fingers cut off. And it's true. You can go to the Mongkok right now and get these amazing servos, which are basically strong enough to cut a chicken bone right in half. Right, and I suddenly realized, well, if that was my finger, oh.
Yeah, and that means you really reduce the value of the technology, because you can't interact with it. You can't fiddle around.
But make it more explosionary. My whole life goal has been basically trying to make robotics better, okay? And one of the big problems of the top-down technique is that it's never broken through that price-performance barrier that essentially is so vital, as the bottom-up approach is basically sort of like shown. Crossing over, basically, you know, it's not popular. I mean, people, it's a lot easier to sit around and just code something. But I mean, like, the new discovery of things like the 3D printers, right, is, I hope, going to change an awful lot of that, provided they find a way to basically put PCBs and conductive mechanisms inside them. I mean, what we have to do is not just build mechanisms, but also electrical mechanisms. The servos I mentioned, you know, like, are very nice, but they're also $700 American dollars each. And you suddenly realize, oh, you know, you could buy an entire army of RoboSapiens for the same cost as that. Now, it's just a matter of trying to basically see how far our customers are able to go. Basically, so like the new, what I call the new gentleman roboticists are able to take, you know, basically what is now a homogeneous field of a large variety of different robots, and then basically start coming up with things that are not just fun and interesting, but also, you know, like eminently practical and hopefully, you know, like profitable. That is something you could put on the shelf that, you know, won't impress us, but will certainly impress the wives and children.
Yeah, yeah. And we see that when we recently talked about security, we talked about the bipedal walkers. We know that there's a DARPA challenge out there for the walkers.
Yeah, $2 million. I mean, I'll tell you right now, that doesn't even pay for my vendor's research and development for something like that.
No. And they're going to do, for instance, they're going to do rescue and fire personnel.
Great idea. No, the fact is it's true. I mean, if you're sending something that could basically run into a building, right, because even dogs won't go into a burning building and find human beings. The problem is you need something that can run into a building and has the same characteristics and sensory abilities and speed as a dog, but it also has to be as disposable as a dog.
Yeah.
I mean, this is something which I saw years ago when I was building demining robots. Standard demining will charge you $88,000 a year, and you can remove up to, you know, like 21 mines a day, whereas a robot deminer can remove 2 mines a day, and it costs $2 million. And the leading cause of death is still, you know, the same between one and the other. It's heart attacks due to the stress. But the fact is that accounting-wise, I mean, human beings are just a hell of a lot cheaper to build than robots, and they're the only thing that can be built with unmanned labor. I mean, that's really important.
So, that was it for today. I would like to thank Mark for being part of the podcast, and I hope you enjoyed it.
And that's all from us for today. If you thought this was interesting, count yourself lucky, because we'll hear more from Mark Tilden in future episodes planned for this year. Also remember to check out our new transcript functionality, which gives you access to word-for-word transcripts of our episodes. Simply visit robotspodcast.com and you'll find the transcript link right next to the episode name. Our next episode will air on the 5th of October. Until then, goodbye. Wowie with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.